This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the author of the misquotable C.S. Lewis. On the show today, I'm featuring the second of three episodes of highlights from the 2018 Lewis and Friends Colloquium at Taylor University. Specifically, today's show features portions from the keynote talks by Joe Christopher and D.S. Martin. However, before getting to those highlights, as I did with the Part 1 show, I'm sharing comments from a few students who attend it. So that's what you're here first. Then I'll share about 12 minutes each of Joe Christopher's and D.S. Martin's keynote addresses. For each of the students, I had them give their first name, some background, and what they enjoyed about the 2018 Lewis and Friends Colloquium at Taylor University. This segment is about 6 minutes, so the keynote highlights follow after them.
My name is Kayla, and I attend Asbury University. I just finished my sophomore year there, and I am an English major. The Inkling who I enjoy reading the most is J.R.R. Tolkien. I started reading him when I was in elementary school, and I really haven't stopped. Before coming to Taylor, I really wasn't quite sure what to expect because I've never been to anything like this. You know, this is my first academic conference. And so I was kind of thinking, you know, I knew that there would be papers presented and a lot of different talks given, but I wasn't sure what the, I guess, social situation would be like. My expectations were so far exceeded. I had no idea that this would be such an amazing community. Everyone here has been so welcoming. And even though, like, everyone here has so much more experience than I do, but they're so willing to share all of that. And just so willing to talk with us, you know, all of the students who are here, and just all of the ideas that have been shared have been amazing. It's been amazing to be a part of this. As far as highlights, the keynote that was given by Joe Christopher on the Phoenix poems, that was very interesting. I had never really read any of Lewis's poetry. And so that was interesting to get to see some of that, and then to see a part of his relationship with Joy Davidman that I hadn't really seen before, because I knew kind of about their relationship, but getting to see what happened, you know, when they were first talking to each other, you know, before they were married, that was a really interesting experience. And then I guess another highlight was the way everybody would hang out and talk at night. That was something that I didn't necessarily expect coming in, but I had a lot of amazing conversations that way.
I'm Hannah, studying at the University of Kentucky. I just finished my freshman year working on music education with a math minor. Tolkien is the Inkling that I think has really affected me first in a lot of ways, but Lewis and MacDonald have also been really important in developing the way I think and just really enjoying the stuff that they've written. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't even know for sure that this was a solely research convention. I signed up a couple weeks beforehand just because I heard word of mouth that it was going to be interesting. My expectations were definitely exceeded because it was a research convention and there's so many interesting people here sharing their thoughts about literature that we all really love. And I guess the highlight is how a research convention could be so academic and friendly all at once. Everyone was willing to talk to me, even though I didn't know a whole lot, and they knew a lot. And it was just a very good experience of community and intellect at the same time.
Christian, Trevecca Nazarene University is where I attend. I just finished my sophomore year, so I'll be a rising junior. And I double major currently in English and History with a minor in Creative Writing. As far as which Inklings I enjoy reading the most, I think Lewis is easily the one I've read the most of, while Tolkien is a close second. But I think Lewis has been, for me, as far as, especially as nonfiction, explicating ideas and reasoning and things like that has been amazing for me because he's, I think, advanced my thinking a lot as far as reading him nonfiction-wise goes. Fiction, obviously, amazing. Before coming to Taylor, I didn't actually know what to expect, and I actually was interviewed and was asked how big is this conference? And I had no idea how big it was, and I had to tell her that I didn't know if it was a big deal or not. And it turned out actually being a lot larger than I thought it would be, and I wasn't certain what to expect as far as the type of company I'd be keeping, or how well-versed they would be. Everyone ended up being 100 times more intelligent than I, and it was an experience. It definitely exceeded everything I would have imagined. I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. I enjoyed every aspect of it, and I thought I would enjoy it a lot, so that's saying a lot. I definitely will be coming back, I hope. And as far as highlights, I think biggest highlight for me is just experience and learning from people around me who know so much more than me, and presenting was a highlight, I think, as well, because there's just a certain amount of adrenaline high that comes with that. But making connections and friends and learning about people is one of my favorite things to do, and everyone here was so friendly, so I guess if I had to put it into three highlights, it would be experience, friendship, and I guess presentation were my favorite things here. Hope to come back and do it again.
Here's Joe Christopher, who publishes regularly about Lewis, including over 20 essays on Lewis's often eclectic poetry, and is on the executive board of the C.S. Lewis and Inkling Society.
What I'm talking about today are two sonnets from this book and one poem by Lewis. C.S. Lewis and Joy Davman disagree about a phoenix. A book could be written about the love of C.S. Lewis and Joy Davidman, and in one sense, a book was written about their love, Lewis's own A Grief Observed. But their connection is more complicated than his book indicates. Anyone who has read Davidman's sonnets to and about Lewis of the 1951 through 1954 period knows that their path to marriage and his path to love had many stones in it. The two sonnets to be considered in this essay come from early 1954 period. At least the first one does, she dated it, and the second probably does. And Davidman, separated but not yet divorced from her husband, William Lindsay Gresham, had been asserting her love for Lewis in the private sonnets for some times. The sonnets are mentioned as evidence, not Don W. King's book, Yet One More Spring, and not Abigail Santamaria's Joy, because this essay is concerned with the two sonnets by Davidman and the poem by Lewis, which makes an interesting dialogue, one may say, between Davidman and Lewis, and not a happy one. Beyond the poems' biographical interests, they're also intriguing as art. Davidman, in sonnet 20, retells a conversation with Lewis. She dates the poem as being written on January 22, 1954. Of course, one cannot prove absolutely that such a conversation took place. No one was there with a tape recorder. And one cannot prove that the date is accurate. But within the limits of conflicting evidence, one usually assumes that manuscripts are correctly dated and that people report conversations with some accuracy. Admittedly, a conversation reported in a sonnet is going to suffer some reshaping to fit the form of the meter and rhyme, but nonetheless, one assumes some truth to the report. In the case of Davidman's sonnet, one bit of evidence will be offered later, which seems to verify it in a very general way. Davidman's 20th sonnet is an English sonnet in form, three quatrains and a couplet. She begins with three uses of the word love in the first two lines. My love, who does not love me but is kind, lately apologized for lack of love. She's writing about Lewis. She continues on about what he said, running on over the end of the first quatrain into the second. Lewis was, quote, praising the fire and glitter of my mind, the valor of my heart, and speaking of affection, admiration. One notices that Davidman, in her enjambment, the carrying over the end of the line, uses of at the end of the fourth line. That is Well, English is rhyme poor on the word love. Of, glove, dove, above, and shove. That's about the limits of the English rhymes. In this case, of certainly keeps the sentence moving from the first quatrain into the second. In the second quatrain, Davidman develops an image of a female beggar. Affection, admiration, bitter scraps, men fling the begging woman at the door when hunger lends her courage and she raps loud at their consciences. So Davidman, wanting to be given eros, physical love, is like the physically hungry woman who gathers her courage to knock, to rap, at the wealthy man's door to ask for food. She is likely, Davidman says, only to get bitter scraps of food to eat. Again, Davidman enjams the movement from one quatrain to the next. She begins in the second quatrain. Why, there was more. One might be surprised that she uses a semicolon, not a colon, but the idea goes on. He, that is Lewis, said I had a beauty of a sort might do for other men, but not for him. Davidman injects the image of demons to symbolize the psychological pain of the coming words that the coming words cause her. At which the grinning devils had their sport and tore me shrieking limb from bleeding limb. One doubts that she literally shrieked, or that it really felt like she had an arm or leg pulled off, but she does get across the idea that Lewis's words pained her. The comparison to being tortured in hell is quite effective. At this point, Davidman has finished three quatrains of the English sonnet. The final couplet in this form of the sonnet is usually spent on an epigrammatic conclusion. The present writer must admit he does not find Davidman's finale ideally effective. She writes, "To be rejected, oh, this worst of wounds, not for love of God, but love of blondes." Lewis evidently did say he was attracted to blondes. Davidman, with her Jewish ethnic background, was dark-haired and to a degree dark-skinned. Was Lewis really attracted to blondes? Who knows? Many men are, but he doesn't say it any other place in any of his writings. And he was trying to discourage Davidman's obvious attraction to his person. He tries to say, "I'm sorry, but I'm just not turned on by your type." Of course, the question of how he approached the topic would say something about him. He could have said it flatly, and that is supported by Davidman's sonnet, although with some praise for certain of her traits first. Davidman's final couplet is not a complete disaster, of course. She was a better writer than that, but it's not ideal. Isn't the exclamation, "Oh, this worst of wounds," a touch of stereotyped tragedy? The alliteration on W and other circumstances might be effective, but here it reinforces the stereotyping. The parallelism of the last line, however, is effective. Not for blank, but blank. Two terms in the structure, each introduced by love of, end with one-syllable words, God and blondes, all in a one-headless iambic pentameter line. Not for love of God, but love of blondes. Since Lewis was known as a religious writer, the irony of his rejecting a woman not because of religious principles, but because she was not blonde, adds an extra piquancy to the use of God in the contrast. A transition. Since Davidman dated the number 22 in her 45 sonnets, there is one trust, no doubt about it. But C.S. Lewis's poem, "The Phoenix Flew Into My Garden," is placed by Don W. King's Collected Poems of C.S. Lewis, that's the big volume of Lewis's poems, into an undated poems section. Charlie Starr, however, working from his study of the details of C.S. Lewis's handwriting, has placed it in the 1950 to 56 period. Obviously, 2nd of January 1954 fits into that period of 7 years, but is not enough to explain the appearance of Lewis's poem here to be discussed immediately after Davidson's poem. That is, why am I doing this? I choose it to follow number 22 in this essay for the sake of one word in the sixth line. Okay, things flew into my garden. The one word in the sixth line, the dark girl passing in the road heard me. The word is dark. This fits Lewis's emphasis on Davidman's skin color, perhaps, and dark hair, certainly, as Davidman exclaims at number 22. Eventually, its content will be tied into Davidman's sequence more securely, but the one word is enough to start the consideration. Lewis's poem is unlike Davidman's sonnet, of course. It consists of 22 lines, not 14, written in longer lines than Davidman's pentameters, and is unrhymed. Probably, Lewis's poem is written in the general tradition of the classical form called the elegiac distich, or elegiac couplet. The classical form consists of a dactylic hexameter line followed by a dactylic pentameter line, both unrhymed. Classical rules about versification, for example, with their use of long and short syllables and their possible substitution of two short syllables for one long in certain positions, are occasionally followed in English, as in W.H. Auden's In Praise of Limestone. But since the English language basically works, as do all Germanic tongues, on the basis of accents, not duration, it is not surprising that the classical model is usually transposed into some general equivalent. Lewis's long lines in each distich are heptameter, and the shorter lines are iambic hexameter. I do not mean that Lewis never substitutes in his meter to allow for rhetorical emphases, etc., but his basic underlying meters are these. He is using the elegiac distich for a fairly short narrative, as was common among the Hellenistic poets, probably losing somebody there, Hellenistic poets, the ones that were writing in Greek in the after the classical period, mainly in Alexandria, Egypt, when the Greeks controlled the Greek-speaking people controlled the area. The meter was also used by Roman poets for varied topics. The content of Lewis's poem begins with the action. A phoenix has flown into the speaker's garden and perched on a sycamore tree. The tree for Lewis would not have been the American sycamore, but the European and British sycamore, a deciduous broadleaf tree native to Central, Eastern, and Southern Europe. It was introduced into England in the Middle Ages, some say a little bit later in the Tudor period. Since it is often planted in gardens for ornamental purposes, and since it is a large tree, it is both big enough to support the phoenix and appropriate for the speaker's garden. Lewis did not pick the sycamore for symbolic or mythic purposes. Since it was an introduced species in the United Kingdom, it has no mythic episodes. The phoenix is, on the other hand, of course, mythic. Basically, it is the legend of an immortal bird that, when it grows old, collects spice branches for a nest, manages to set the nest on fire, and dies in the flames. And then, after a period of days, is reborn from the ashes. In the medieval bestiaries, it is quite often compared to Jesus' death and resurrection. Having established the identification of the phoenix, we may consider Lewis's narrative in the first stanza as an allegory. Lewis, in 1930, becomes a Christian. That is, he accepts that Jesus is God, the Son, and that is, in the poem, the phoenix appears, flew into the garden.
I hope you enjoyed this portion of Joe Christopher's keynote address. It's just an example of the excellent speakers you can hear when attending the Lewis and Friends Colloquium at Taylor University. At the time of this recording, the next one is scheduled for 2020. The show notes to this podcast will give you links to the Center for the C.S. Lewis and Friends website and the Colloquium's website. I'll give more information about how to find those show notes at the end of the podcast. Next is some of what D.S. Martin, a poet, had to share during his keynote address, which featured some of his poetry.
I'm not an academic. I'm somebody who fell in love with reading C.S. Lewis when I was quite young. And what I found really surprised me. Well, I read everything I could get my hands on about Lewis when I was in my teens. And then I went back and started rereading Lewis relatively recently. And what amazed me was I realized that an awful lot of the things that I think, that I believe, that I hold true and I hold to be mine, I actually stole from Lewis. I was reading things and going, oh, that's where I got that. Or that's where that idea came from, because he was and is just so good at communicating and explaining things and thinking things through that even his way of thinking began to permeate my being. So I found that fascinating. First of all, I want to say that Lewis, what he really wanted to be was a poet. And to be honest with you, and I think among friends we can admit this, he wasn't a great poet. I love so much about Lewis, and there are some of his poems I really like. But he was not a great poet, and I think there's a couple reasons for that. But to me, one of the things about Lewis was, in his poetry, a lot of the time he was trying to win arguments. He was trying to convince us of things. And ladies and gentlemen, that's not what poetry is for. Poetry is for us to present ideas, to give people experiences, and have them think things through. And when Lewis tried to win arguments or convince us of something in a poem, it just doesn't work in a poem. I mean, it works amazingly in so many of his other pieces of writing. And is it, another thing that I found was amazing about Lewis when I was rereading him was his analogy. He is so good at coming up with analogies. How many of you would agree with that? That Lewis's analogies, he would just naturally say, you talk about something we couldn't understand or get our fingers on, and he'd come up with an analogy of a way to think about it. So I've taken a few of those and just run a little crazy with some of them. Anyway, I'm going to just start reading for you, and then I'll talk a little bit about my path. This first poem is it's called The Longing, and it is influenced very much by Surprised by Joy. I didn't just read Surprised by Joy. I read a number of other good biographies of Lewis. But in the back of this particular book, I have put a footnote for each poem to tell you where the information came from, like where the ideas came from, what it sprang from. And my hope is when you read my poetry book, it drives you back to Lewis. And obviously, in this crowd, I don't think I need to work hard at that. But a lot of people, when they read my poem, they then go and look and see what was going on. So, for example, this poem, Longing, I just say that it comes from the material in Chapter 1, The First Years of Surprised by Joy. And in on page 12 in my old Fontana paperback, he's talking about this longing. And he identifies it with that German word, which I can't pronounce, and so many of you can. Is it Sehnsucht? Thank you. And what he says about six pages later is, it had taken only a moment of time. And in a certain sense, everything else that had ever happened to me was insignificance in comparison. So this is obviously pretty significant to him. This poem is called The Longing. It came to him, staring toward the Castlereagh Hills from an upstairs window. It came to him from a homemade toy garden in the lid of a biscuit tin. It came from the sight of steamers down below in Belfast Lough, and the sound of a ship's horn at night. It came from the interior space of the rambling house his father designed, rooms filled with books and long book-lined passages leading to empty sunlit places, books piled in the attic and too deep in the bookcase on the landings, where the distant sounds of pipes, of gurgling cisterns, and of the wind's breath would wind through corridors to find him beside the comforting fire. It came most, perhaps, from the loss of his mother, first through dire illness, and finally through death, the longing for longing, the desire for desire. This next poem comes from Reflections on the Psalms. I would just find different things and play with them. This is called The Sacred Fish, and it comes from that word, those three words, the sacred fish, come from the very end of the chapter in Reflections on the Psalms. So I took his metaphor and ran with it. The sacred fish. You can't desire to catch the sacred fish as much as he desires to be caught. And yet, he darts through the dim depths with tail swerve and swish, laughs with the joy of glistening fins at huge holes in your net through which he swims. To get the shining coin from his mouth is worth selling all you have. To get him, even better. Everything you know about him wavers in uneven light, just below the surface, so it's barely wet. You let down your net as he dives to the bottom. You seek the depths as he leaps through waves. You search the shallows as he heads for open water, and your tattered nets come up empty. If you let him, he'll repair them himself, trim knotted clumps and untie tangles. Selecting the right fibers, he'll tear and twist the sinews of your heart into fine mesh, stretch them as thin as a pin, as wide as your whole being, a needle shimmer piercing your soul. Better is one day in his boats than thousands elsewhere. This is from another analogy. It's called Bottle. As pure beams of morning infiltrate your window, the cut glass bottle high on the ledge cannot be hid. It catches light, dazzles, refracts, but cannot hold it. Placed under a bushel, dark emptiness is immediate and complete. I know whoever's not against us is for us, and whoever's not with us is against us. Light glints off the glass in different ways. I know he blessed the peacemakers, yet came to bring a sword. Taught love your enemies, yet hate father, mother, wife, children. It's like trying to bottle a sunbeam. Some subtleties splash from the rim and splatter the ceiling. Its substance overflows the brim and puddles the floor. Even what clearly brightens the interior beautifully makes its escape, diffused through a glass brightly. I thought this would not be complete if I didn't make some allusions to Narnia. So this poem is called What Lucy Saw, which is the title of one of the chapters in Prince Caspian. It's just to refresh your memory, the children have returned to Narnia, but they have not seen Aslan. And then they're trying to find their way along paths. And then Lucy, she sees a glimpse of Aslan, and he's indicating to her which way they should go. But none of the others see Aslan. None of the others believe Lucy. Although, in the end, Edmund decides that since last time he didn't believe Lucy and she was right, that this time he should. And it's to me that's kind of a redemption, a symbol of redemption in Edmund. But anyway, so this is called What Lucy Saw. And if you know Prince Caspian well, I hope these images will come back to your mind. On the day after the night on which she woke and wandered through pools of moonlight and spoke to the trees, a whispered invitation, almost an incantation to also waken, that made them rustle in the windless air and to almost heed her, the children became lost in an unfamiliar wood. It was then she saw him, between two mountain ashes, before he vanished like some evanescent vapor, a great lion, the great lion, his mane outshining the sun, there, then not there, where he'd been unseen by the others, leaving her verity unverifiable, unbelievable, though believed by one who'd not seen, who later received his well done. And this one is from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It's called The Possibilities. What did the professor mean, nothing is more probable, when asked of possible worlds everywhere just around the corner? I know how unobservant I can be of all that's plainly before me, never mind the microscopic, the subatomic, the spiritual, the possibilities from unimagined dimensions, colors lost in shifting light, shapes obscured by descending darkness, rising fog, a closing door. Might the end of time reveal all existence as simultaneously real from the history of each place? I'm a squid on the ocean floor, unaware of the water, a willow dancing on a creek bank, unconscious of the wind. A small girl tumbles through a wardrobe into a wood filled with unbelievable truth, a parallel world. She has proven herself reliable. Why should we not believe her?
Again, you've been listening to the second of three podcasts featuring highlights from the keynote addresses given at the 2018 Lewis and Friends Colloquium from Taylor University. Today's show had Joe Christopher and D.S. Martin in the spotlight. If you haven't already heard the first one with Stephen Prickett and Charlie Starr, then check the show notes for a direct link to it. You can also learn about other shows related to this colloquium in those notes. You can get those show notes at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. Alternatively, you could go to where the audio files are hosted at allaboutjack.podbean.com. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. And in case you didn't know, you can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes. If you don't know how to do that, the show notes will help you to get to there because it has a direct link. Finally, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host for All About Jack. In addition to my new book for 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis, I have an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters that is entitled C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell.